Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us today. Gotta love your Sundays. Especially Sundays when you get to talk politics. At least that's me. I like my Sundays when I get to talk politics with Professor Sidney Milkus. Good morning.
Morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm just great. Good to be here with you.
Well, I always enjoy having you here in the studio.
I always enjoy being with you.
Professor Sidney Milkus, the White Burkett Miller Professor and the Cavaliers Distinguished Teaching Professor in the Department of Politics and a faculty associate at the Miller Center, author of Rivalry and Reform, President, Social Movement, and the Transformation of American Politics in 2018. How about that? A new book.
That's right. A new labor of love.
And the Cavaliers Distinguished Teaching Professor. I hear that got you season tickets at the football stadium and in JPJ for basketball games.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. You know, I do teaching because I love it, but to be rewarded in that way is not only an honor, but it's being a sports fanatic. It's just probably the best prize I've ever won.
I mean, that got a lot of jealousy. Glowing looks from some of your peers.
Maybe, although they were very kind, gracious, in congratulating me for winning the award.
Well, and I can tell you from the handful of times, I think the fourth time maybe you've been with
something
me.
Something like that, yeah.
Fourth, fifth time you've been, I have to look back on Seville Podcast. I'm well-deserving,
I'll say. Oh, thank you,
Rick.
Thank you.
And if you go, I can't think of the place to go look, but UVA allows these students to go and give grades to the professors, mm-hmm. so that before you take a class, you can go look and find out just how hard it is.
Yeah.
People always say that your classes are challenging, but with a great professor.
Oh, that's they're very generous, my students.
Yeah. So thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rick.
We are going to talk about politics, and we're going to start with the second anniversary of President Trump in office.
How about that? Seems like a decade, doesn't it? so much stuff has happened.
Well, when I've been trying to get you back on the show, we started talking in the fall. Your book was coming out. You had a lot going on. And we settled on January 20th. And we were talking about this in the lobby. At the time, I don't think either one of us realized that January 20th was the exact 2-year anniversary.
That's right.
President Trump in office.
Yeah, I didn't realize it, but it's good. It's good. It gives us a bit of a focus today, huh?
Yeah. So we'll start there.
Okay.
Yesterday, President Trump tweeted, "No president who has accomplished more in his first 2 years in office." So I'm curious, as an academic historian, focuses on presidents. Your thoughts on that? Has President Trump actually accomplished more than any other president in office in his first 2 years?
I think I can safely say no. I mean, when you compare him to presidents like Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson or Ronald Reagan, Trump's accomplishments pale in comparison to those presidents who all left a really impressive record of achievement. But I will say that one thing that distinguishes Trump in terms of doing something unprecedented is, I don't think, Rick, since the presidency of Andrew Johnson after the Civil War during Reconstruction and the kind of disruption that he reigned on the effort to reconstruct the South. I don't think, Rick, we've had a president who's violated so many norms that have developed around the presidency. And in that sense, you could say that Trump may be the most disruptive president we've had, one who's raised the most important constitutional questions in a really long time.
Well, let's compare those two then. President Andrew Johnson after the Civil War and President Donald Trump after what would be his reason.
Yeah. Well, you know, just as Andrew Johnson, although he was Abraham Lincoln's running mate, Lincoln put him on the ticket in 1864 to have a national unity ticket. Johnson was the only Southern senator from Tennessee not to join the Confederacy and stay with the Union. So in 64, Lincoln rewarded him with the vice presidency and a national unification ticket. But he was essentially a Jacksonian Democrat who believed in states' rights. He didn't believe in secession. He believed in the Union, but states' rights. So much of his presidency was about preempting the progress that followed from the Civil War, emancipation efforts to make sure the freed African-Americans had some basis to become citizens in America. And he really was a vanguard in arousing opposition in the South that preempted and eventually led to the demise of Reconstruction. The parallel might be, Rick, that President Trump follows the first African-American president, President Barack Obama, who, of course, served two terms of president. And a large part of Trump's, really, it began with the birther movement, which really established a platform for him to emerge as a contender for the Republican nomination. But it's continued into his presidency, where, as one of his aides put it, his leading objective has been to erase Obama's legacy. And so to preempt much of the record of the first African-American president who advanced really some important progressive causes, particularly in areas of LGBTQ rights and immigration rights.
Well, so I have two parts here. I'll try and remember them both.
So, I'll remind you if you miss one.
So President Trump says he's accomplished more than any other president in his first 2 years. Does it get to count if the majority of his work has been removing, demolishing, undoing the work of the president he's following?
Yeah, I don't think so, because, I mean, when we talk about achievements, we talk about enduring achievements, and that requires not only executive action, unilateral action. For example, what he's done with respect to immigration, undoing DACA, which became an important issue again yesterday with the president's attempt to do something about this impasse and the government shutdown. But really, Rick, the only piece of substantial legislation that has passed in the Trump administration is the tax cut. And that's significant. But really, in 2 years, that's pretty remarkable in the absence of achievement that one can expect to endure beyond one's presidency for some time. Because if a Democrat's elected in 2020, they can do much of what President Trump has accomplished, because much of it was done through unilateral executive action. And if a Democratic president's elected, they can very easily reverse or depart from a lot of those initiatives. So one could also talk about the Criminal Reform Act that was passed, and that's pretty important. But I think that that and the tax cut kind of pales in comparison, say, to all the legislation that was passed during Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, to all the legislation that was passed during Johnson's presidency, much of which is still in place. So think about the Social Security program that was created during Roosevelt's presidency. Think of the civil rights laws that were enacted during Johnson's presidency. These are monumental achievements that have become embedded in the fabric of American, of our political heritage. And I don't think the tax cuts or even the criminal justice reform is important as that law might turn out to be, can be compared to the achievements of those presidents. Again, I think more of Trump's accomplishments, and maybe he sees this as an accomplishment, is disruption. He seems to love chaos and disruption. It seems to be an environment in which he's comfortable.
Our guest today, Sunday morning wake-up call, is Professor Sidney Milkus from UVA in the Department of Politics. Cavaliers Distinguished Professor. So part two of this was you're talking about Andrew Johnson following Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, his goal seeming to be to bring the United States back together, maybe in a difficult way, correct?
Right.
And President Trump following our first African-American president, we seem to be, and he's sort of dividing the United States. We seem to be at opposite ends of this 150-year time period, doing opposite things. Johnson bringing us back together after Lincoln ending slavery, theoretically. Now we have an African-American president, and here comes President Trump saying and doing things, and we can get into it a little bit later with white nationalism and coming more to the forefront of daily life and sort of dividing United States a little more.
Yeah. I think Andrew Johnson, his and this again, I think, suggests some parallels with President Trump. His notion of bringing the country back together was founded on the really kind of militant idea of states' rights. Again, not one so much that would lead to secession, and you're right that he did believe in the Union. But one that conceded the South's commitment to white supremacy. So the cost of bringing the South back in the Union that Johnson was willing to pay, and I don't think Lincoln, had he not been assassinated, would have paid this price, was a real retreat on African-American rights, first in the Black Codes, which weren't quite returning to slavery, but established what was really falsely considered a system of separate but equal. And the Jim Crow laws, which, you know, stayed in effect, Rick, until the 1960s, and the civil rights laws that Lyndon Johnson saw through Congress. So it was an idea of the Union that was based on America in the 1850s, before there was an effort to make African American citizens with a full share. And I think President Trump's idea of making America great again comes at the cost of challenging many of the progress that's been made since the 1960s. And really, Obama kind of represents an heir apparent to Lyndon Johnson and the civil rights laws that were passed during the 1960s. And in particular, President Trump has advocated a retreat on immigration rights and LGBTQ rights that were advanced in important ways during Lyndon Johnson's presidency. So, you know, I used to watch Leave It to Beaver as a kid, and it was all, you know, you had this family that wasn't under stress, and everybody, there were no people of color in that show. I think, Rick, you and I are somewhat of the same age. You may have watched that show as well. And I think Andrew Johnson's idea of reunifying the country was a return to the 1850s. So I think President Trump and many of his more extreme followers want to deny the massive changes that have occurred in the country, demographic and socially, since the 1960s, and return us to a situation of the 1950s.
So we're talking about Andrew Johnson. Under Donald Trump, was Andrew Johnson one of the presidents who won the Electoral College rather than the popular vote?
No, he was succeeded to the presidency when Lincoln was assassinated, because as I talked about, he was put on the ticket in 18.
Right, but did he win a second?
He did not. No, in fact, he was.
He did not get an next term.
And this points to how controversial he was. He was impeached for his aggressive attempts to resist the Reconstruction program of the radical Republicans in Congress, the kind of Lincoln Republicans that used to dominate the Republican Party. He was impeached and was by the House, and just avoided conviction in the Senate by one vote.
Wow.
By one vote. So he almost was thrown out of the presidency. But the legacy of his resistance to Reconstruction was a really regionally divided country, particularly the North and the South. And the South became a one-party region, the Democrats, because of the hatred of the Republicans due to the Civil War.
But that's completely those brand names, Republican and Democrat, have changed dramatically. From what they
have. Gosh, we can get in the weeds on that. That happens in the 20th century, but when Johnson was president, the Democrats were the states' rights president, were the states' rights party, and the Republicans were the more nationalist party. And the Republicans controlled a majority of the country, but the Democrats tended to because of their lock on the South. Were able to become competitive again in the Congress and in the Electoral College.
But there are, we talk about how President Trump won the Electoral College, but not the popular vote.
Right.
What, there are others whom that happened to, correct?
Right. Three times. I wrote this down so I wouldn't forget it, Rick.
Okay.
Three times in 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes, the Republican candidate, won the Electoral College, even though he lost the popular vote to the Democrat Samuel Tilden. In 1888, due to the fact that there was Reconstruction had fallen apart, and there was a lot of fraud and corruption with the Electoral College, and four states were challenged, and the Republicans and Hayes managed to win the Electoral College, although Tilden, who was a governor of New York, won the popular vote. Then 1888, Benjamin Harrison won the Electoral College, although Grover Cleveland, the Democrat, had won the popular vote, again, largely because of the almost unanimous vote in the South. And of course, the one our listeners will remember is 2000, when George W. Bush lost the popular vote to Al Gore by 500,000 votes, but won the Electoral College. And remember the controversy down in Florida
that
eventually ensured
the hanging chads.
Those chads that were hanging on for dear life, rather than cast a vote for Al Gore. And really, in some ways, what's going on now can be seen as a trajectory of what occurred in 2000.
So I was going to ask, the first two obviously didn't go on to win second terms.
Right.
But President Bush did.
Yeah.
And he even had some moments of popularity.
Yeah, he did. I've been humbled a lot over the last couple decades in a few instances. And one was, I remember as soon as the controversial election of 2000 was settled, Rick, I said, well, looking back to the 19th century, whenever this happens, it's unlikely the candidates, the guy who wins the Electoral College and loses the popular vote, is going to be elected for a second term. And sure enough, Bush was reelected in 2004. And we can talk a bit about why that happened.
All right. Our guest today, Professor Sid Milkus from the Miller Center, as we talk about politics Hang tight. We'll be back. All right, back in action here with our guest today. Professor Sid Milk is talking about the second anniversary of President Trump in office. You know, even when he got up there on stage to accept the office, even he started that day was questionable. The number of people out out in front, you know, the very next day they were questioning the comparison to President Obama.
President Trump has, you know, and this is no news to our listeners, has been a constant source of exaggeration, misinformation, and it does start that first day when he claims more people were at his inauguration than President Obama's, and all kinds of aerial footage and so forth prove pretty convincingly, Rick, that's not the case. The other thing that the most striking thing about the inauguration that I remember, and I remember I was at Oxford for that time, and people in England were just fascinated and I have to say a little appalled by what was going on in America. So we did an inauguration event at Oxford, and I had to preside over that. And I was just struck by how negative that inaugural address was about the state of the country. Usually these are times to provide an uplifting message and prepare the ground to unify the country after an election. President Trump doubled down on the kind of conservative base he had rallied in 2016, and just had a horrifying view of the state of the presidency: murder, drugs, being duped by an international trade, pursuing fake news and fake science in terms of climate change. And I don't think I've ever seen or read an inaugural address that had such a dark view of the country.
You know, I had said I wanted to jump into another section, but I'm going to skip down and go to something else. Okay. I want to talk about...
It's your show.
media
yeah.
access.
Oh, yeah.
Because he has yet to have a State of the Union address, has he?
He had one in January 2018.
Did he have one last year?
He did, yeah. And that was, you may not remember that, because that was sort of an interlude in the Trump presidency, in that, say, compared to his inaugural address, that was pretty, he was pretty statesmanlike and calm. He read from the prompter, and he didn't ad lib in the way he tends to do. But he did make a State of the Union address, and it was rather favorably received, but the glow only lasted about a couple of days, because he returned to the kind of politics that's been more characteristic of his presidency.
He hasn't had a full solo news conference in nearly 2 years.
Yeah, I think
that's rather unusual for a president.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, you know, since Kennedy, really, presidents have attempted to reach beyond the press and speak directly to the people. And of course, Kennedy pioneered the use of television in that regard. But no one has been as negative about the press, has accused them of being, in Stalin-esque terms, the enemy of the people, and is constantly harped about fake news as President Trump.
Did we even have that phrase, fake news, until President Trump? I don't remember it being used.
I don't remember it. It's certainly fake. You know, presidents have accused the press of falsehoods. In fact, if you go back to Thomas Jefferson, when he was attacked for some of his policies, he claimed that the press was falsely damning some of his policies. But no one has engaged in a kind of drumbeat of attack on the establishment press as much as President Trump has. And I would add to that, Rick, that no president, although Fox News certainly has been supportive of conservative and Republican politics for a long time, no one has kind of had the cozy relationship with Fox News, almost turning, you know, using it as a voice, his major voice beyond the Twitters, that his use of Twitter as much as President Trump has. You know, Nixon attacked the press, particularly as Watergate emerged. He attacked ABC and NBC and CBS, the Washington Post, the New York Times. He went to court, of course, to try to stop the Pentagon Papers from being published by the Post and New York Times. But, Rick, I don't remember Nixon referring to the press as the enemy of the people. That's pretty strong stuff.
Here we are within this two-year anniversary, and I haven't, my notes show that since February of 2017, so we're fast approaching the two-year anniversary of President Trump's last solo news conference.
Yeah. He does hold impromptu, small kind of sessions.
Right, on his way walking.
Walking or on the plane.
Rose Garden on the plane, yeah, correct. Yeah. But not standing
not
up
standing.
In front of
yeah.
Where Ms. Sarah
Huckabee Sanders,
thank you.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of her.
Yeah, we were both kidding each other about our
sometimes lack of names.
Our ability to grasp names. We got that one pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And man, talk about.
But he doesn't walk out there and do that.
He doesn't. And you know, this is where Kennedy really was so talented at using the press almost as members of the press as props to appeal effectively.
But you would think that would be his thing because he doesn't need a teleprompter.
Yeah, but...
Or he doesn't want a teleprompter.
Yeah, but he's, another thing that really distinguishes President Trump, he's the first president who doesn't have any experience in public service. The first person with complete private experience as elected to the presidency. And so consequently, unlike my dad, who was a businessman and loved to read about history, President Trump seems to be very impatient when it comes to reading books or even reading memos from members of his cabinet and White House staff. And so he's not really comfortable in going into depth or playfully interacting with the press over policy and events. He's much more comfortable doing that over Twitter or in speaking to Fox and Friends.
And he's also, has any other president started seemingly, seemingly started to run for their second term as early as President Trump has?
The tendency in the country has to move towards a more permanent campaign, but in a lot of things we see with President Trump, he hasn't started things all the time from whole cloth, but he brings them to a dramatic culmination. So I mean, President Trump never stopped the 2016 campaign, Rick. And a lot of presidents, and we saw this with Obama, after the election, they will try to reach out to the opposition and appeal beyond the base that elected them to office. And almost every president has done that to some degree in recent history. But President Trump has never done that. Almost all of his politics has been about securing and strengthening his relation to the Republican base. And that makes sense in terms of how polarized the country is. But in terms of navigating the crises like we're going through now with the government shutdown, it's a disaster, Rick, because this is about 40% of the country. And no president, I think, has had lower public approval ratings from President Trump. And that starts right from the beginning. No president, Rick, after their inauguration. And this, again, has to do with that harsh inauguration address, has entered the presidency with lower numbers than President Trump did in 2017, January 20th, 2017.
Again, we are talking about the second anniversary of President Trump. Our guest today is Professor Sidney Milkus from the Miller Center. He is the White Burkett Miller Professor And the Cavaliers Distinguished Teaching Professor.
Right. Also from the Department of Politics. I have two homes. I always have to.
The Department of Politics.
Yeah.
It's season ticket holder.
And season ticket holder. Sports fan. I'm still mourning yesterday. Well, we were not going to talk about the Duke game, right?
We're going to talk about the one in 21 days.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be there.
Duke game.
Yeah.
That's one we want to talk about now. Let's talk about turnover.
Mm-hmm.
Has any professor
we have a lot of turnover
any,
in our
have
in
any
our
other professors amongst yourself had a chance to talk about other administrations with problems similar to Professor Trump's turnover rate?
You called him Professor Trump.
Well, he is a professor. He's a professor of turnover.
He's a professor of turnover, yeah. You know, there's since the presidency became a more personalized office, and again, this really becomes significant with John Kennedy and the White House office. Really,
he always goes back. President Trump always goes back to President Lincoln.
Yeah.
Oh, he always goes since President Lincoln.
Yeah.
I don't know why he goes back to President Lincoln.
Well, sometimes he talks about Andrew Jackson and compares himself to Andrew Jackson, who might have been the first populist president we ever had. And by the way, Andrew Jackson had a lot of turnover in his cabinet. And that might be an interesting historical parallel, another one we could draw between Andrew Jackson and Trump. So, but in modern history, no president has as much turnover as the Trump presidency. And no presidency, although this has been a trend for a while with the development of a really expansive White House office, has surrounded himself with, and after 2 years, this is really evident, with people who will follow him with such blind loyalty. And so nobody in the White House office says, will speak truth to power to President Trump, tell him he's making huge mistakes, or warn him about taking a course of action that's not going to play well in the country. So
you say that, but somebody seemingly, use that word again, is telling the media something, because there always seems to be news about what's going on inside.
Yeah, and we don't know who those people are, do we? We don't know. This anonymous editorial in the New York Times, we still don't know who that was.
Right, and there always seems to be thought that he's being told what he's doing is wrong, and he does it anyway. That seems to be the inside story. I'm telling you what's going on in there, you know, what's about to happen, or what the inside scoop that the media knows about to tell the rest of the United States.
Yeah, and some of people who are concerned about President Trump refer to these as the grown-ups who did manage to get into the Trump White House and the cabinet. But Rick, over time, over 2 years, the people like, and most recently with Secretary of Defense Mattis, those kind of people have been leaving, and people who are more sympathetic.
Right. The grown-ups are leaving.
And they may be grown-ups, but they're loyal grown-ups. Yeah. You know, Stephen Miller in immigration is a really good example of this. I mean, John Kelly was pretty harsh in terms of immigration. He was at first head of Homeland Security before he was brought into the White House as chief of staff, but not nearly as visceral in his, if I can say this, nativism as Stephen Miller is. I can only imagine the discussions between Stephen Miller and President Trump after yesterday, where President Trump, and this is the first sign of a little desperation on his part, threw out the idea of extending DACA, this relief, deportation relief for Dreamers, for young people who are brought to the country as children, and are now undocumented immigrants
in
the country.
In his two-year time period, you opened the show by talking about how little of his own work, President Trump's own work, has really been accomplished in his initial 2 years, and that whatever you want to call it, that offer got immediate negative feedback.
Right.
The Democratic Party says no, and the extreme right corner right. of his own Republican Party says no.
Yeah, Ann Coulter, and President Trump seems to worry a whole lot about what Ann Coulter says, is already was after him as harshly as Pelosi and Schumer were yesterday. And the immediate rejection from the Democrats, we were talking about this, Rick, and right before the show, is that President Trump, for a businessman and priding himself on being a great dealer, has missed the first important premise of making a deal that will stick, in that you have to build trust with those whom you want to make a deal. And you've worked in small with a small business firms, and my dad was a small businessman, and we have learned, I learned from my dad, you from personal experience, if you're going to make effective deals, you have to build some trust with those you're trying to deal with. And President Trump has done the opposite. And he did that with about a year ago with DACA and the budget, when the last time we had a shutdown, I believe, or it may have been two times ago. I think
he's made so many people unhappy.
Yeah.
So many of his own Republican Party unhappy, where he said, let's do this.
Yeah.
And then when they start working on it, he's changed his mind and said, that's a horrible idea. I don't want to do that.
Yeah. Most recently, when he cut a deal, well, you know, the Republicans in the Senate thought they had a deal with him to pass a temporary budget so that there would not be a government shutdown. And then after people like Ann Coulter went after him and he was afraid that the base would retreat, he changed his mind. And I'm sure Schumer and Pelosi think, well, if we take the chance of going for this DACA deal, which is not really fully what we want a path to citizenship. This is just deportation relief. Even with that more limited agreement, he's likely to pull out of it if he gets an attack from the right over the next few days.
I'm curious. He's had so much trouble with the media. Have other presidents had so much trouble with the media, or is this just a sign of current times as the media has become more of a, you know, we always talk about 24-hour media. Is this just the state of where we are? You know, we can go back to President Nixon, who we just talked about.
Yeah.
Right. Did he have more trouble with the media then because of Watergate, or, you know, but it wasn't the world that we lived in now?
Yeah. Nixon, like President Trump, always felt that the establishment was out to get him, and so he did feel the media was unfair to him. But again, his problems, he was doing pretty well with the media. You know, Nixon won an overwhelming landslide in 1972 over George McGovern. I think he won every state but Massachusetts, I believe, and then Washington, D.C. And so he had some success in appealing more broadly.
Well, he did some great things in China.
Yeah, in China.
He did some very popular and unknown things.
He reached out to liberals. I mean, Nixon was the one who created the Environmental Protection Agency. But President Trump has tapped in to the kind of fragmented media that has been created since the late 70s. And he gets along just fine with Fox News and a lot of talk radio hosts. But he resents very strongly the established media, New York Times, Washington Post, and the cable stations like CNN. That's the fake news. So it's not like he doesn't get along with any media, but he's really, in a way that is unprecedented, has come to rely on what has become the conservative press.
Again, our guest today is Professor Sidney Milkus, Department of Politics at UVA and the Miller Center, here today. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about his book, Rivalry and Reform, Presidents, Social Movements, and the Transformation of American Politics. And here we are, back in action here on Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Are you feeling progressive, Sid?
I always feel progressive when I'm with you, Rick. I feel like I make a lot of progress. It's so fun to be here with you.
You know, it's I feel like we're only viewing the President Trump second anniversary from one side of things. So we need to make sure to include some other viewpoints of this. So I want to talk about social movements.
Mm-hmm.
You do have a new book that came out, Rivalry and Reform, Presidents, Social Movements, and the Transformation of American Politics. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. What this book argues that the major transformations in American politics partly come from our most consequential presidents. And that's really the conventional wisdom on how these changes occur. So, for example, recently Lyndon Johnson's civil rights reforms and Ronald Reagan's kind of launching of a more conservative politics in the 1980s. But the argument of the book is that politics is not just top-down, neither is it just bottom-up, as sociologists argue, that in all these major periods of change, there's been a kind of tense but really productive relationship between presidents and social movements, a kind of fascinating interaction of top-down and bottom-up politics. So with Lyndon Johnson had a kind of fraught but really important relationship with the civil rights movement. Tomorrow's Martin Luther King's birthday, and he and Lyndon Johnson for a few years before Vietnam broke really worked effectively in passing the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Acts. And then Ronald Reagan really developed a close relationship with the Christian right, in fact enlisted the Christian right into the Republican Party, and they really became in 1980 the foot soldiers of the Republican Party, and have remained that even through the presidency of Donald Trump. Because he's embraced some of the conservative positions of Ronald Reagan, particularly with supporting traditional values, what are called traditional values by conservatives, and making Supreme Court nominations, the Christian right, in spite of his cussing and the fact he's been married three times, has been very supportive.
And has loose hands.
I wasn't going to say that, Rick. I was warned about radio norms before I came on here today. In spite of all that, the Christian right has been very strongly supportive of President Trump. So the essence of the book is that part of the juice of our politics comes from strong presidential leadership in alliance with the passionate politics that bubbles up from the grassroots.
I'm curious if Ronald Reagan and the Christian right and Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King and the civil rights. Does the Trump election, are those similar to Donald Trump's election in the populist movement mm-hmm. in any way?
Yeah, I think in a sense, Rick, Trump has embraced this idea of the importance of social movements in a way that even more than Ronald Reagan did. That is, Ronald Reagan knew how important the relationship with the Christian right was, but he also knew he had and it's a delicate operation. You kind of have to keep them at a little bit of a distance in order to appeal more broadly to the American people to win the overwhelming landslide that he won, for example, over in 1984 over Walter Mondale. Whereas President Trump has really doubled down on his relationship with the Christian right and then the Tea Party, which emerges during Obama's presidency. Which is sort of an extension and a slight they have a close relationship in their views and their organization to the Christian right. But President Trump has added a new dimension to conservative populism in his relationship with some of these kind of conservative nationalists. And we saw this, Rick, with his appointment of Steve Bannon from Breitbart, a kind of alt-right media outlet. As a top aide in his administration after he became president, This kind of conservative nationalism departs from kind of Reaganism in three ways. One, most broadly, it's much more negative about the state of the country than Reagan had. Always great optimism about America. It was a city on the hill. It was morning in America again. Even though he opposed liberals, he felt the state of the country was really good. The people were really good. President Trump has a much more kind of polarizing negative view of where we are as a country. And two other things more specifically, Ronald Reagan, conservatives are free traders. President Trump has pushed this, again, this kind of populist nationalism that flows from people like Bannon, who was in many ways the architect of his 2016 campaign. And President Trump has continued, even though Bannon left the White House, to follow that script. President Trump has pushed protectionism, which has been very disruptive for the economy, I think. And then the second thing is immigration, that President Trump had a positive view of immigration and supported it. Again, following this kind of view of conservative nationalism, President Trump has been much more negative about his view of immigration, particularly undocumented immigration, but even with respect to legal immigration, particularly from certain parts of the world. So that has added a new dimension to conservatism. And you've seen some of that in the past at the fringe, like with Pat Buchanan challenging Bush 41 in the 1992 primaries. But it's now moved to the core of the Republican Party. So the Republican Party under President Trump, and this may make sense given how polarized the country is now, how base our politics has become a much leaner and meaner party under President Trump.
Do you see, so President Trump in the most recent elections, the November 2018 elections, mm-hmm. the midterms, many Republicans chose not to run again, whatever their excuses were. I can't win. I've been here too long. Mm-hmm. I need to spend time with my family. Mm-hmm. Are the Republicans going more to a Trump type of Republicans, or are the Republicans splitting?
Mm. Well, you know, it's a great question. And both of those are possibilities. That is, they could be splitting, and that could be a path towards a much more Trump-dominated presidency. And I think that's the direction we're going. So the question is, Rick, what happens to the Republicans and some more, if I can put it this way, idealistic Reaganite conservatives who feel uncomfortable if they're not fully alienated from Trump? What happens to them? The Jeff Flakes. Do they come? Kasich. The Kasiches.
Yes. Where was Kasich? Yeah, they say he's going to run again, but he didn't win the first time.
Yeah. So he's thinking about a third party run, independent candidacy this time. And so what happens to them? Do they try to form a new kind of conservative party based? Do they become a great analogy, because as you know, Rick, because you're a great student of history, the Whigs died after they were replaced by the Republican Party. Or do they join the Democrats? And one of the interesting things in 2018, Rick, was a lot of moderates in the suburbs voted Democratic. And that was largely responsible for the Democrats picking up 40 seats, which is the most House seats the Republicans have lost since Watergate.
Well, and this new young woman from the Bronx...
I can't think of her name either.
But many people find that she may be going too far left and taking a fair number of.
Yeah.
And so the Democratic Party may be going too left. And so now may be the time for there being quite a middle party.
Mm-hmm. There might be. If the Republicans and I think this is going to be fascinating to watch in 2020 and what the Democrats do. And this is really starting now with this, I don't know whether to call it a mud wrestling event or a chess game with President Trump over.
I think
over
it's mud wrestling. You're
right, well, you think that now, over the government shutdown is how, what does the Democratic Party do? Do they try to move to the center a bit? although still being progressives, and emphasize things like economic issues, like shoring up the Affordable Care Act, which has been weakened administratively under Trump? Or do they go hell-bent towards, maybe that's a bad analogy, I should use a more neutral now, do they veer towards the kind of Sanders, what's become the Sanders, Bernie Sanders wing of the party, and push things like universal health care, and a more uncompromising position on social issues like immigration, like getting rid of ICE, for example. That'll be fascinating to watch. If the polarization continues, the question, Rick, is there enough? Are there enough people still in the middle to form a kind of third or independent party that could somehow move beyond this polarization? I must say, I'm pretty skeptical about that, because the one thing we didn't talk about at the very beginning, although we've hinted at it, is the country was polarized before Donald Trump. It's a hell of a lot more polarized right now.
Have you found in your work that people are willing to think before they vote, or do they just vote for the letter following the person on the board?
Mm, it's a good question. I think partisan loyalty has been really important in voting, going back to, I think, the 60s. It's become much more important since then than it was before that. And the regional splits have really been a significant part of that. Rick, I think one of the things that's happened in the Trump presidency is as a professor, I call it a great teaching moment, in that President Trump has been so iconoclastic and so disruptive that he's awakened people to issues that really they didn't think a whole lot before about: constitutional norms, about the consequences of elections. I mean, a lot of my most liberal friends didn't vote in 2016 because they thought there was no difference between President Trump and Hillary Clinton. A year in, they had changed their minds about that, and we saw the consequences of that in 2018. So I think, and this may be the idealism of a professor that's not warranted, but I think people are more thoughtful about how they're voting now than they were before the presidency of Trump. I don't think people are quite as visceral in the country. Tribal is the word that's used all the time. Yeah, as they were before. But, of course, we'll have to see how this plays out.
I have judicial and government shutdown left on my sheet.
Oh, my goodness.
I'd be horrible not to get into government shutdown, so let's do that.
Oh, okay.
So for 2 years, the two-year anniversary, I have that the Reagan administration had 8 shutdowns lasting 4 days or less. Mm. Bush 41 had a weekend shutdown. Clinton administration didn't have any shutdowns during their first 2 years, although they did end up having a 5-day and a 21-day shutdown. Yeah. Obama did not have any shutdowns during their first 2 years, although they did have a 16-day shutdown. And President Trump has now had a 3-day, an overnight, and the current
shutdown. Yeah, where are we? We're past the 21-day.
This is 26.
Yeah, so the 21-day one under Clinton, the battle between Clinton and Newt Gingrich, right. That was the longest before this.
Yeah.
So now this is the longest shutdown.
And it doesn't look like it's going anywhere soon.
Yeah, although it'll be interesting to see how the reaction to President Trump's...
To play a lot to his radio and TV folks.
But it's not working. It's not working. And, you know, the Democrats...
And Mitch McConnell has a big hand in this.
Well, he's been absent.
Well, that's why.
We're going to put his picture on a milk bottle, Rick, because that guy has been missing.
He won't even bring it to the floor to see what his other Republican followers, his other Republican senators want to do.
That's because we talked about this. That's because he was burned by President Trump before the shutdown. He thought he had a deal to keep the government open, and Trump reneged on that. And so he's been burned, and Mitch McConnell doesn't get burned twice usually. So he's going to wait and see how this, we called it mud wrestle, this mud wrestling battle between Nancy Pelosi, it's mainly between Nancy Pelosi and Trump, plays out. And I think it's going to play out quite a bit longer. I think the way it'll break is there'll be enough Republican, and I could be completely wrong about this, Rick, because I'm better at explaining than predicting, but I think the Republicans in Congress, if the public opinion polls continue as they have, and this continues to play so negatively towards President Trump, then there might be enough cracks among the Republicans in Congress for there to be a movement to open the government.
Well, just a 2 minutes left or so. So the judicial aspect, within his two-year time period, President Trump has been quite active and quite successful in the judicial aspect.
Yeah.
Two strong conservative appointments.
Gorsuch and Kavanaugh.
Court.
Yeah.
Although
huge shift. Huge shift. Yeah. Really important shift.
And numerous dozens and dozens and dozens of conservative court appointments to the lower levels.
Impellate and the district court, yes.
Right.
Yeah. And now we have, the Republicans almost like vultures flying around her
or
looking at Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Right. Although she seemingly, she wants to stay almost until there's another presidential election.
Yeah, but of course,
Health.
I'm sure Antonin Scalia didn't expect to stay as well, and
right.
some nature may take its course there, which would really, if President Trump is if this happens before 2020, that would be another really important development on the courts. And we should have talked about this in the beginning, and we have a minute to make clear that this may be president, even if he's not reelected in 2020. This may be his important legacy, is the changes on the court. And,
right.
and again, this goes back to...
Because they're young.
They're young. Oh, yeah, he's always said, I want somebody on the, my list who's going to give me 40 years. And yet, imagine 40 years this person's going to be in there.
Right.
And it's like a name. It's like Trump will be on the front of the Supreme Court, like it is on the front of Trump Tower. And that's extremely important. This is a desire conservative Republicans have had since the Reagan presidency, and with the Federalist Society, to really establish a conservative court. And President Trump has moved the country down the road quite a bit on that front.
Our guest today has been Professor Sidney Milkus from the Miller Center and the Department of Politics at UVA. Cavaliers Distinguished Professor. Look for him at the football games and the basketball games.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks. And don't forget his new book, Rivalry and Reform, Presidents, Social Movements, and the Transformation of American Politics.
Yeah. Bless you. Bless you for mentioning it. Thank you.
Thanks.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SevillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.